This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. I'm Celeste Quinn. In this portion of the program, we look back to a summer day in Chicago almost 90 years ago. On July 24, 1915, thousands of people gathered on the banks of the Chicago River to board one of three boats to cross the lake to Michigan. The occasion, the annual outing for employees of Western Electric's Hawthorne Works. The 1915 picnic planned for Washington Park in Michigan City never happened. One of the boats, the steamship Eastland, capsized at the dock, claiming the lives of 844 passengers, men, women, and children. My guest this afternoon is Jay Bonensinga, a writer. His latest book is about the Eastland, the title The Sinking of the Eastland, America's Forgotten Tragedy. Jay, thanks so much for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you so much. And that was a beautiful overview.
Yeah. Well, this is such a tragic story. And my parents grew up in Chicago. My grandmother was a young immigrant girl, not long arrived from Ireland when this happened. So
yeah, so you probably identify with a lot of elements here.
Yeah, so yeah. It's quite a page-turner for me.
Well, thank you.
Why has the story of the Eastland, though, been largely forgotten?
Yeah, that's a fascinating question. That really was sort of a central question that I dealt with throughout the 4 years that it took to write this thing, research and write it. And, you know, for a long time I thought, well, it has to have something to do with the fact that there were no celebrated people on this ship. You know, there were no Astors and unsinkable Molly Browns. You know, it was basically salt-of-the-earth immigrant working-class people. But lately, I have to say, ultimately, I've come to believe that the reason that it was sort of lost in time has a lot to do with the victims of the disaster themselves and how they live their lives. I really believe, and this has been confirmed by a lot of descendants, that they just did not talk about it. It was so horrible and tragic and sudden, but they just moved on. This was how they lived. They just, you know, girded themselves and said, "It's happened. Let's deal with it. Let's move on, and we don't talk about that anymore." And oddly, history, or at least scholarship of the event, kind of followed that lead.
Hmm. The capsizing in the river didn't spell the end of this boat's service, which I find is just so interesting.
I know, isn't that fascinating?
The boat was renamed, and at one point it carried President Roosevelt on a summer cruise. Now, you know, the day that this boat capsized in 1915, there was so much sorrow, not only that day, of course, but the days and weeks and months that followed. There was so much sorrow, grief, and anger.
Mm-hmm.
Why wasn't the Eastland taken out into the lake and sunk?
Or like given a Viking funeral. You know, I agree. I that's one of those maddening things that's also fascinating about the era and the aftermath of the disaster, because it was as though they just wanted to stuff this whole event down into oblivion, and one of the things they did was just completely, just repaint the ship and clean it and renovate it and rename it and eventually the Navy acquired the actual vessel and renamed it, put some guns on it, and turned it into a training ship, and it served for decades, literally, until the late 40s, and then in 1947 it was decommissioned. And this is the frosting on the cake, Celeste, you won't believe this, but it was turned into an exhibit at the Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago. No mention that it was once called the Eastland, and it was once the deadliest disaster in the city's history. No mention of that at the museum.
That's amazing.
By that point, it had been completely, fully whitewashed away and forgotten.
Yeah. The Eastland was a boat that, as far as I'm concerned, should not have been on the water, at least not with passengers.
Right.
Tell us a little bit about her flaws.
Yeah, well, there were literally warnings throughout the 12 years of its service. It served for a few years after it was launched. It was built and launched in 1903, and you know, for a few years, the early years, it served on Lake Erie with no mishaps. But the boat kept being rehabbed, and cabins kept being taken out, and more floor space put in, and at one time even a concrete floor was put in to the ship, and the maximum capacity sort of seesawed up and down, and it became what they referred to as a cranky ship, meaning it was sort of unstable in the waterways and in the loading and unloading, and it leaned, and it had incidents, and even maritime engineers wrote letters saying the ship is an accident waiting to happen. But again, all this is kind of obscure, and you know, by July 24th, 1915, a lot of this stuff had just sort of been rumor and innuendo and kind of, you know, sort of hidden in the minutiae of running this business, you know, these excursions across the lake. So, boy, after the disaster, though, a lot of these people came out of the woodwork. And so it was chilling to see some of this evidence.
Yeah. The boat had been called Cranky by its sailors, and apparently the sailors who worked this boat had to be pretty good at what they did in order to keep it sailing.
Yeah.
And the captain, you know, that morning, I wonder, as all these people are coming aboard, did he have any qualms about knowing that the ship was, to put it mildly, cranky?
Yeah, that's a fascinating question, something I've puzzled over. Because his actions were, you know, to say the least, enigmatic, and he certainly was a villain to me. Once the ship went, you know, he sort of pushed to get out while the ship is rocking and pitching and leaning, listing, and looking troubled before it even cast off that morning, and he got one of them. But he, as the ship achieved vertical stability, he said, "Let's just get going, you know, let's put out right now," and that was probably the fatal decision, because they couldn't even get the last mooring rope off before the ship just slammed down on its side and instantly killed hundreds. But, you know, I think he sort of lost his mind. Maybe he was hubris, you know, maybe he was, you know, troubled himself, but, you know, in the immediate aftermath, he tried to stop welders and construction people from cutting holes in the hull to rescue dying passengers trapped in the ship. And he was, you know, literally, you know, carried away by an angry mob. But, you know, I visited his grave when I was researching it, and this is just a quick side anecdote. I visited his grave, and when I laid eyes on his meager little stone in the ground, and all it said was Harry Peterson and the dates of his birth and death, and nothing that he had been a master of steamships, and it was just overgrown and untended in this small farmland in Michigan, small cemetery in the, you know, Michigan farmland, and all my anger just drained out of me. Mm-hmm. I'm just thinking, you know, maybe there was some kind of cosmic justice or reprisal, you know, because he just sort of lived the last years of his life in shame and, you know, died anonymously.
Yeah. This tragedy took whole families, and the survivors had such harrowing tales to tell. Although, as you mentioned earlier in the interview and as you write about in the book, they didn't dwell on these stories, but you have uncovered some of their stories and you tell them here. And maybe you would tell us just a little bit about the family that came so close to perishing but were rescued, the Anstads.
Yeah. Yeah, that was really the gift from God, so to speak, for me as a writer, because I needed that central figure, a true life person to sort of kind of revolve the story around. And so I happened upon this family that runs this historical society, and their grandmother was a 13-year-old Norwegian girl who was on the ship that day, who was trapped in an air pocket and survived. She was in the air pocket underneath the ship for 11 hours with her widowed mother and sister and uncle. And I truly believe, although she died in the mid-90s, and I never met her physically, at least, I feel like I met her through all her diaries and oral histories and journals and family histories. I believe she saved her family with just her pluckiness. And, you know, so she was sort of the symbol of the people who were, you know, on that boat. And I was able to, you know, sort of craft a narrative with her being the central hero of it. So I really thank the Wachholz family and the Eastland Disaster Historical Society for giving me Borghild, Bobby Anstott.
Yeah. There are stories of great valor here. Tell us a little bit about the divers who worked on rescue and recovery.
Yeah, the divers were incredible. I mean, these people were these staunch, big, tough guys who were used to diving into the Chicago River to build pilings for bridges, and you know, they were not used to something like this. And they worked tirelessly with these gigantic, you know, 19th century hard hat dress, you know, outfits to dive, connected to the umbilicals, and they went inside that ship and they saw just, you know, horrendous tragic scenes, you know, people dying in each other's arms and children, and they recovered body after body, and they, you know, girded themselves with whiskey every time they'd come up, and they worked for hour after hour. And I really saw them as the heroes, just as I saw the Undertakers.
Mm-hmm.
There's a principal figure in the book who's an Undertaker, because the care of the dead was an amazing part of this story. You know, they ran out of caskets. There were so many dead. And the following Wednesday after the disaster, they called Black Wednesday. And, you know, the cemeteries were just jammed with processions. And entire families were wiped out. Entire blocks in the Cicero community west of Chicago were just dark and gone after this disaster. It's just, you know, it's almost incomprehensible still to me. And I've tried to write a book that at least helps scratch the surface of, you know, comprehension or some kind of, you know, re-experiencing it. But, I mean, it was just beyond description, the sorrow and the grief. And, you know, I think that's why its time has come after 90 years to bring it back into the, you know, sort of the American mythology. I mean, maybe that's a little, you know, maybe that's a delusion of grandeur of mine, but I really think that this should be as celebrated as you know, the Titanic and, mm-hmm. you know, and other disasters.
Yeah. Well, we don't have time to tell the Titanic story. That is, it's kind of a sidebar, but it's very important in the story of the Eastland, but we have to put that one aside.
We'll tease the listeners.
Yeah, there you go. But... you know, something, we've got to wrap up here, so I've got this last question for you. One of the stories I heard about this as a kid made Western Electric look pretty bad. While this was billed as an exciting excursion, expenses paid by the company, some called it a PR stunt, and there were stories that workers were pressured to attend. That's what I heard when I was a kid, and you addressed this
That's
in the book. Can you shed some light on this?
I think that I debunked that myth. I think that the company did a good job of caring for their people. I think that they came out of it looking good because there might have been floor managers or foremen at the plant who, you know, went overboard in selling tickets. But the company as a whole and the you know, their protocol was magnificent. I think today all the lawyers would come out right away, you know. But this company turned their entire factory into an information center in the aftermath. They paid for funerals for poor, for the, you know, people who couldn't afford it. They extended insurance policies for people. I mean, they really, I think, came out looking great, in my opinion. And, you know, by the way, they were very helpful themselves in creating mm-hmm. this book because the company Western Electric is now known as Lucent. And Lucent is, I don't know if they're one of the few companies, I'm not personally aware of this with other companies of that size, but they employ a full-time historian. So they were, it was a treasure trove of information and newsletters and memoranda, you know, that I got my hands on.
Yeah. Well, there are some more stories of heroism here in terms of the women who went to the switchboards and worked, you know, to keep people informed of what was happening and that kind of thing. So it's a good thing that we can kind of address that old story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's myths, there's urban folk tales. Everybody, a lot of the old timers in Chicago think the ship went over because everybody crowded to one side.
Mm-hmm.
Which, as you know, after reading it, is not really true. It fell over to the port side, and most of the people were sort of cramming over on the starboard side. So it's really, that's one thing that's rewarding about writing a book like this, is you sort of set some records straight.
Yeah. There we have to say goodbye. I want to thank you very much for telling this story and for joining me this afternoon, Jay.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Jay Bonansinga has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. His latest book, he's a writer, his latest book is about the tragedy of the Eastland, the sinking of the Eastland, America's forgotten tragedy.